Hello and welcome everyone to episode 8 of the Odds and Ends podcast. I think unlike the other episodes, there's a chance this isn't episode 8. But, you know, we're just going to 80% for this episode 8. With me, I have Garrett Jones, who is an economist at George Mason University and also has written three books, probably more than three books, honestly, but three books that I know of, The Hive Mind, 10% Less Democracy and The Culture Transplant. And in particular, I'd recommend 10% Less Democracy as one of the best books of its kind. I don't say that lightly. It gives a chapter on a number of different interesting questions about how democracies could function better and an example every time. And in my opinion, that's the best way to write a book of that kind, you know, to have problem, solution, move on. I think many people would have labored that into sort of two or three books, and therefore it's a credit to Garrett that he didn't do so. Garrett, how are you doing today? And what is your relationship with forecasting?
Oh, I'm doing great today. Thanks for having me on the show, Nathan. So, well, I was trained in time series econometrics at UC San Diego, which is, and time series is the economic tool most widely used for forecasting, right? So two of my professors shared a Nobel Prize eventually for part of their methods. And we just did a lot of grunt work. And I practiced in grad school using the software of the day, just trying to figure out how macroeconomies behave in the short and medium run. And that just gives me practice with a sense of error bounds, uncertainty, structural breaks, all the things that super forecasters have to wrestle with. We were dealing with just using, say, usually just US GDP data. And that gave me a lot of practice. Of course, being down the hallway from Robin Hanson means that I get to think about prediction markets, futures markets for ideas. And so there's this both very applied econometrics approach that I have experience with, and then this more theoretical Bayesian probability theory approach that I have some experience with.
Okay. And as I think we're going to spend most of our time here talking about AI, but I couldn't miss out on the opportunity to ask a question of the following form, which is, I might give some context and ask it. I've heard on other podcasts, I listened to your podcast the other week, and you were saying if you wanted to test some of your sort of culture transplant theories about the idea that actually the culture of the country that immigrants come from really matters, if you were to test that, you'd have to sort of run 20 years of, you know, like you'd have to really test. You can't necessarily immediately give policy answers. And so first of all, you may have to correct me if that's wrong, but if it's not wrong, my question would be, are there anything you could predict, any sort of natural experiments you could see, anything you can imagine a country doing where you could say, look, if they were to do this? So I tested Kaplan on a different podcast a while back, and Brian said, well, if a country, he said something along the lines, if a country has a big influx of immigrants, then I would expect that to be a pretty good thing, sort of almost regardless of where they're from. And I'm sort of hideously misquoting him. You can go on Pradyumna's Prasad's podcast for that. But suffice it to say, he gave an example of like a test that we could have run but might get run naturally, and I wondered if there were any of those for you.
Yeah, definitely. I start off my book, The Culture Transplant, with a version of this, a hypothetical of what if hypothetically a large number of more or less average folks from communist China migrated in large numbers peacefully, voluntarily, to some of the world's poorest countries. And I have a pretty clear prediction about that. And my prediction is they would not assimilate. They would not assimilate to the low productivity culture of the country they moved to, either in the short run or their descendants in the long run. And one reason I believe this is because there have been large-scale, voluntary, peaceful Chinese migrations to countries across Southeast Asia. And there's a reason we use the word Chinese diaspora. There's a reason we use the term market-dominant minority. These are terms that we use when we see assimilation not happening. And thank God it doesn't happen, right? So I think it's a very safe prediction that if say in the poorest 10 to 20% of the countries in the world, if a random selection of those countries were fortunate enough to have large-scale migration, peaceful and voluntary, from China, from folks who didn't have a lot of money, who showed up with just a little bit of savings, maybe a high school education, and you waited 30, 40 years, you would see large-scale productivity increases for the economy as a whole. You would see widespread diffusion of obvious forms of prosperity. And you would see normal measures of institutional quality, the normal measures that libertarians like to keep track of, would be increasing over that time period. 50 years is what I'd rather see, but I think 20 to 30 years, it would be kind of too obvious to ignore.
And so, I mean, I think probably it's going to be really difficult to pin down a forecast. I mean, maybe at some point, maybe in discussion afterwards we can, but I don't necessarily desire to do it here. But, you know, if we sort of say things going really well for those countries, for some of those countries which get that, how confident are you? You sort of say you think, you know, six would be probably going to happen. Are you really sort of saying, you know, and obviously this is an actual forecast. Yeah. But, you know,
it's imagining a natural experiment, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. If you were to guess that, you would know, you and I hashed this out with sort of reasonable, how confident are you that this would be the case?
Yeah, I'd say like of 10, if there were, say, 10 countries that happened to and 10 somewhat similar countries that didn't happen to, the 10 countries that happened to where you got to say 20 to 40% folks of Chinese background moving to the country persistently, kind of like Malaysia.
Yeah.
I think within 50 years, it'd be very clear that there'd be, I don't know, 50% higher GDP per capita, maybe 80%, and that prosperity would be fairly widely diffused. It would be clear that the benefits were not
over,
just going to the other folks.
Like over all those countries, all the 10 and not in, you know, so maybe in a few of the others.
But yeah, so 10, some would be higher and some would be lower, right? So I'd say the median.
But you're really sort of saying like your confidence, I don't know, is like, I don't know, 75% higher, right? Like you're really quite confident.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have no example. Okay. We have no counterexamples. The big counterexample, of course, is communist China, right? China is the world's poorest majority Chinese country. So 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 5, depending on how you count, majority Chinese countries are extremely prosperous and doing well. And so that gets me to a 75-80% confidence, I'd say. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And like, do you, obviously, I guess Malaysia is not a good example because Malaysia is itself a country that's relatively similar to China. But are there any countries which you sort of think are a pretty good shoe-in for this kind of effect in the real world? Or you just have?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, part of the reason we would say Malaysia is similar to China is because the population's about 30% Chinese, right? And they did not assimilate, right? Europeans did not assimilate to the culture of North America. Chinese migrants did not assimilate to the culture of Southeast Asia, to the cultures of what we think of. I mean, in the pre-Chinese migration period, many observers would have lumped together, say, Malaysia and Indonesia into one cultural group. Of course, there are many differences, but Malaysia and Indonesia fairly close to each other. One country wound up with 30% folks of Chinese background. One country wound up with about 4, and we can look at the differences in prosperity today. Of course, I'm not saying that's literally the only reason, but I think it's a big part of the reason.
But you therefore would be advising the heads, particularly of like smaller, say, Western nations, poor nations, I guess, particularly around like Hong Kong, if something goes wrong with Taiwan, maybe North Korea, you'd be saying you should try and jump on these immigrants. You should try and get them to come to your country. You know,
exactly.
There's like a real chance that you could quite considerably boost your country. If you get the lion's share of the Hong Kong immigrants, that's probably going to go really well for you.
Especially if you're a poor country, right? If you're a rich country already, you don't have as much to gain, right? So one of my critics made a foolish comparison of saying, hey, when Chinese folks move to America, they wind up a lot like Americans statistically. I'm like, yeah, that's my prediction. So the goal, it would be the real gains are for countries that are in the poorest 10 to 20%. Those folks should be trying to hire the best advertising agencies possible to pull in Hong Kong and Taiwanese refugees if those unfortunate scenarios arise. So, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Okay. So, and are there any other examples that you think, like, are there any other examples that, I don't know, that we should be watching in the space? I guess those, China seems like the really obvious one, but are there any others where you're like, oh, this, yeah.
I picked China because it's an example where the median person isn't that rich and where there's a large number of migrants that we already have data on who aren't that rich and have moved to a new place. In other cases, you know, if the median American moves to a poor country, well, they're bringing a lot of wealth with them, right? And they, or at least they bring access to their home country wealth, networks of wealth. So it's not as much of a ceteris paribus, other things equal comparison. I'm really trying to look at what people are bringing with them as individuals in their own minds and in their patterns of behavior with others. So I'm trying to isolate that. And so that's why China makes such a good example, both because it's important on a large scale. I recommend the book, China's Second Continent by a New York Times reporter, about the medium scale migration of folks from China to sub-Saharan Africa. And that's a really interesting book for giving you a sense of what a culture transplant looks like on a small scale. If you really want to see what a culture transplant looks like on a bigger scale, one needs to look at the literature on Chinese migration, the Chinese diaspora across Southeast Asia.
And I guess I'm going to give you, before we move to AI then, I'm just going to give, are there any other predictions that you would make on your own work? Or I guess, you know, why not, we'll throw it open to other sort of GMU professors. You know, are there any other things like of this natural experiment where you would say, you know, you think that Brian would take a bet against you, where you would say, look, if this happened, then I think it's going to go like this, you know, maybe something. Are there any disagreements like that that you think could be settled by a natural experiment in the world? And let's just like get you down on paper before such a natural experiment happens.
Well, I mean, lately the fun one is thinking about unmanned aerial phenomena, the new name for UFOs. So, yeah, I'm guessing I'd be willing to bet that this just turns into kind of nothing again. So,
So your UFOs, how confident? I mean, I think someone made a good point that really it's very difficult to be confident. Very few of us are really meaningfully calibrated on anything other than like maybe throwing and catching below the sort of like 1 in 100 scale. But, you know, yeah, what's your confidence on UFOs?
I think I have a very high level of confidence, partly because my Bayesian prior is really low, right? Either there should be a lot of aliens or none. And my Bayesian prior would be fairly diffuse across those outcomes, right? Either there should be a lot, we should be able to just look out in the night sky and see that there are galaxies that are arranged in obvious numerical patterns or in strange colors. Or alternately, we should just see nothing. And we basically see nothing. So the fact that the case for UFOs being some kind of aliens or an alien probe requires a very narrow space of outcomes where the aliens are basically invisible, kind of like angels. Really means that I should have require extraordinary evidence to persuade me that these very fuzzy pictures, these weird things people have seen, even showing up on computer sensors, are aliens from very far away. Yeah.
Okay.
So there should be nothing, or there should be a ton. And
one over what n are we choosing? One over, you know, we're talking 1/10, 1/100, 1/1,000.
10,000, 1/10,000. Yeah.
10,000. Okay. Yeah. Let's not mess around. That is.
Yeah, I mean, and part of it is because
probability.
I think one reason I stick with this is because I grew up in a religious background. I was raised LDS. It was a great way to grow up. And, you know, when you're young, you hear a lot of pretty impressive miracle stories. And even as an adult, some of these miracle stories are pretty darn impressive, right?
Yep.
And I don't think they're signals of a God interacting with Joseph Smith.
I used to be an evangelical, so I've heard.
Yeah.
A lot of kind of similar stories.
And yeah, people come back from the dead and miracles and healings and whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So. To any listeners, I will say there's genuinely, I think people who don't live in or near religious communities will just be surprised by people who you otherwise would completely trust for everything. And then they'll tell you a story where there's like multiple people checking. And I mean, there really are stories where I'm just like, I just don't know why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, I'm not saying I think a religious thing happened, but I'm just curious. I've got no idea what happened, how this person knew this piece of information. Was it just purely random chance? I didn't see, but I really like, you know, if you haven't talked to some like trustworthy religious people about miracles, it is a pretty wild experience.
Yeah. So I'll throw back a question to you here. One of the, you know, effective altruism is utilitarianism more generally, would the strictest version would just say truth is instrumental to well-being. And so basically we should choose to believe truths that will boost utility. So, you know, what's the case for self-delusion on or preaching? What's the case for A, self-delusion on religion, and B, basically lying to others about religion? Because it obviously has these big social capital benefits, apparently.
Yeah, I guess I guess I would give, like, I don't know that there always is the median EA position, if I could guess it. We'll do them in order. So my position on this is just like, I'm only like mostly a consequentialist. And so some consequentialism in me says, well, we should just try and work out what's true. And that it will be useful for us understanding the consequence of our actions. It might seem for a long time like it's useful to delude ourselves, but then after that period, it might turn out it was more useful. You know, that there may be a local maximum, and it might take a long time of traipsing before you come to an even higher maximum. And I might argue that around, say, we don't quite know what's going to happen with, say, LGBT stuff. I think it might turn out for a time, like, we could look back and say, oh, this kind of progressivism was very accepting, made everything worse, it made marriage worse, it made like child rearing worse, something. But I guess my sense is that like many of those problems are fixable, and the sort of playing by the rules of people get to choose who they fall in love with, which is sort of like a different axiom here. It turns out, I just think we're going to come out ahead eventually. So there's like some sort of consequentialist logic towards truth, just being like, we'll come out ahead eventually in the long term, no matter how long it seems, eventually. But I don't think that's doing most of the heavy lifting for me. I just think I have like a repulsion towards lying. Mm-hmm. And some would call that a flaw, I think. And I think this is like a rationalist trait more than necessarily an EA one, but I think it's quite common to see rationalists who will talk in very consequentialist terms until you ask them to utter even a small lie, in which case they are just completely repulsed by it. And I think that's like a pretty good trait. I don't know that it's consequentially the best, particularly when it leads, you know, towards turning off people who would otherwise be your friends or allies, you know, do I look good in this dress kind of scenarios. I think there is a non-lying answer to that. You can sort of, you can talk about how the dress makes you feel. I love to see you, darling, and find a way that doesn't sound like you're saying the thing I've just said. But, you know, I think like that's true. I think the EA medium position is probably like, I guess the vibesy position is something like, oh, it probably is going to turn out the truth is more useful in the long term. But I think as most medium positions go, it won't turn out that that's actually what the median person believes. Like, median people are actually very strange. So really it's going to turn out all EAs have like strange views on this. But the sort of community vibe around it is like, yeah, we just tell the truth anyway. Though I think reasonably you might wonder how robust that is, right? Like, I guess I feel like the truth-telling norms within rationalism are more robust to saying really uncomfortable things, whereas EAs are more prone to saying, okay, well, like, if you could just simmer down a bit on that. And I don't know how to predict what that will do.
That's an interesting point, the EA rationalist disjoint on candor. EAs basically have decided they have limits on their candor.
I think this is like pretty reasonable on a like an acting in the world level. I think everyone doesn't want to hear your thoughts on everything, and I think but I guess on like on a personal or on a community level, I probably don't feel that way, and like, you know. And that's just a... Though I guess I do find, like... I do... some part of me in a consequentialist sense does think that truth-telling is really useful, because many things that you think aren't that relevant or important can turn out in time to be relevant and important. So you say, it's not really important that we tell truth-telling in that area. It just seems like sometimes... I'm trying to think of an example that isn't just like... You know, I guess probably LGBT stuff, again, seems like a nice example here, where people would have previously said, look, this isn't a question of like of nationwide morality, it's just a question of personal morality. People, they can just keep that quiet themselves. We're not going to fight to defend that kind of behavior, you know, like, whereas it's turned out in the fullness of time that like very many people would wish to express LGBT behaviors, but they were suppressed by a sort of nationwide fear in most countries. And so... Yeah. While it would have been possible to say, look, this isn't our business, we're not, you know, we're about, I don't know, reducing racism, or we're about reducing poverty, there isn't a large constituency to help here. It turned out the constituency so needed help that they like that level of truth telling, but then it might have destroyed that party's ability to act anyway. So I find hard to think about, but again, my biases are just towards terrifying levels of truth telling.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Rishi Joshi, the philosopher's book, Why It's Okay to Speak Your Mind, on this. So he basically talks about how there's an epistemic commons, and we need to contribute to the epistemic commons positively, because otherwise, a few people just showing up yelling, saying "Don't talk about that" is enough to scare people off of the epistemic commons. But there really is some chance that on any particular issue, you're making the world a whole lot better by sharing an important truth. And it's not this isn't a drop dead argument. This isn't a category killing argument. But once you think of the world of ideas as a commons, you realize, oh, it's a public goods issue, and some people are going to try to privatize it, and all the typical econ problems of loose property rights kick in the world of ideas. And I think that pushes me in the direction of at least having some subcultures that are really pro candor.
Yeah, and I think it can be quite surprising too how this summer's, like, I think the justification against candor is often, I mean, one of them is around discomfort and people's feelings matter, and I like that's like a that's something I take seriously. But another is around like other people buying or believing it and being able to ally with you. But it's not clear to me that one holds up quite so well, because I mean, look at Yudkowsky. He's managed. You would really think that somebody who wears a fedora, who talks openly about, you know, people he fancies on the internet, who has written just unbelievable sort of feats of like soft core erotica on rationalist topics and published them under his own name. You'd really say this was somebody who it was impossible to ally with, and nobody would be seen touching this guy. But,
and yet he is at the forefront of one of the most important intellectual and political movements in the world. And he may not feel like he is, but he is, right? Yeah. He's the rallying point. He is clearly the focal point of the movement.
I don't necessarily agree with it, but like, I think he just has, in the UK, I guess that Trump is similar. Boris Johnson, he like made lots of mistakes. Mm-hmm. You might have said like, oh, this was weakening him. But I might argue the opposite, that over time, people just sort of, they priced in the mistakes. And so that he was capable of making a lot more mistakes than anyone else, because people were just like, aha, Boris Johnson. I think Trump is kind of similar. I think Yudkowsky, again, it turned out that now nobody can say, oh, he's a weird guy, you shouldn't listen to him, because everyone's like, oh, no, we know he's a weird guy. We've known for a long time.
Yeah, that's already baked into the cake. Yeah, that's priced in. Yeah, great phrase.
This is exactly the argument I would make, so I'm somewhat dubious of it. But it is, it's what I believe. Well, I mean, that seems like a nice point to move to as a discussion of AI. Mm-hmm. I guess, what do you think is going to happen?
What I expect to happen is that there's going to be a lot of AI diffusion and AGI diffusion. There are going to be multiple models floating around, and different varieties of those models. In a way, even if it's centralized, it'll still end up being decentralized, right? We watch how people use ChatGPT, and everyone can use it in their own way. So even if there are only a couple of leading models, I think there'll be 1,000 flowers blooming with copies, with hacking, with the open ability to use different AIs. So the idea of there being a single super AGI that just fooms ahead of us seems very unlikely to me. So, many of the catastrophe scenarios are built around that, the sort of Skynet type scenarios. And as a result, I think that the most likely outcome is that we have this gradual diffusion of artificial intelligences being used alongside human intelligence on a regular basis. It'll be really noticeable. In education, it already is really noticeable. I think its diffusion into the technology world is, a couple of years down the line at a high level outside of coding. And it will lead to many bad things, and it will lead to many more good things. If the human species was really easy to destroy, maybe it would have been destroyed by now. So that's part of the reason it's a small part of the reason why I am not a mega doomer.
Is it?
And I have particular arguments for particular critiques of extreme doom scenarios, but I think just in general, the fact that technology takes a long time to happen and that most innovation is not about just raw brain power, but about people getting in labs and people doing engineering, that slows down the process of innovation from FOOM style 1 to 2 week scenarios to slower pace scenarios where we wind up with a world much more like the polyarchy we live in.
Okay, so let me just think about. So I'm just sort of you don't sort of like say by 2030 or by 2040, you don't think, I guess those two things come together. You don't think that intelligence is all we need. So you don't see a sort of like recursion. Is that you don't see one model really just pulling way ahead of all the others, or one instance of one model? That's something you think is pretty unlikely.
I think that's pretty unlikely. And B, I think that, I've thought about intelligence a lot, and I don't believe that raw intellectual brain power itself is a source of destructive potential, right? One needs to get out into the world and run experiments and try things out in order to do a lot of things. So I guess the most direct answer to your question is it's possible that that one model ends up much better, but then the diffuse use of those models by many different agents ends up effectively giving us multiple models, right? So if it's basically, you know, to think of it another way, like if we clone a bunch of von Neumanns, you could say on some level they're all von Neumanns, but everybody gets to talk to a different von Neumann.
Yeah. So I guess I think the kind of counterpoint to this would be something like, what is, that might be true of like small jumps in intelligence, but even if I'm surrounded, but maybe not in sort of really large jumps in intelligence. So I'm sort of like 10 times as clever as like everybody else I interact with. I can put on a mask of being roughly as clever as they are, but then slowly over time manipulate them to doing roughly what I want, and slowly, like, you know, occupy this key social positions and get the resources and the power that.
Yeah, that's the assuming a god part right there, right?
Yeah, and what's...
Yeah, that's screenwriter levels of problem solving, right?
I guess, to me, I'm like, there seems like there should be a number for which, if, mm-hmm. you know, you maybe you're responding, I need to be 100 times as intelligent as everyone, or 1,000 times, or maybe you don't even think 1,000 times as intelligent. It seems to me likely that if I hung around in the spaces I did, but I was 1,000 times more intelligent, or if one of my friends suddenly became 1,000 times more intelligent, that I wouldn't notice. And if they were trying to stop me from noticing, and they could like get me to, well, I'd certainly get them to do more stuff because they'd be so competent. And then like, I'd probably listen to their advice, and then other people would be too. And over some amount of time, they could slowly, you know, we're sort of really talking just like blasting out of the park.
Yeah, so this is a version of knowledge is power, right? And this is a common meme among people worried about ASI, is that they believe that knowledge is power. And so my two responses are, well, have you looked at people, right? When we look at individuals who are two, three, four standard deviations different in intelligence between two folks, is the person with the 145 IQ vastly, totally able to control the person with a 75 IQ? And I think the answer is no.
Okay.
They're not able to manipulate them. They can't convince them to sign up for a savings account that's either for or against the person's best interest. I just think looking around at how differences in intelligence manifest themselves in the world right now should make us somewhat skeptical of that claim. The 145s are not running the world. And they're not even able to, like, if they aren't even able to manipulate the 100s in their own family.
Okay, so I guess the response that I... So I probably... Okay, I think my initial response to this is like, but maybe we're talking about a difference that's like much larger than 45 IQ points.
Okay.
Maybe yeah. we're talking about 200, 300, 500, 1,000 IQ.
Yeah.
We're sort of talking...
And Yudkowsky makes the point that like they're thinking so much faster, the computers are thinking so much faster, that they've got a million years to think about something that we can only... Their 1 minute is like would be like a million years to us, right? And to which my answer is like, does a million years of just thinking about physics help you solve all the physics problems? No, you need to be in a world where there's a lot of physics going on and notice what's happening and collect a lot of data in order to make a lot of progress. So I just think raw thinking power doesn't get you that far.
Okay. Just to sort of dwell on this point for a moment, how confident are you on that? Because sort of, or to say sort of the way, like, how surprised would you be if it turned out that you know, we find ourselves in 10 years' time in this sort of like this boom world,
uh-huh,
where yeah. you know there is
like
one
GDP has been
AI
growing 50% a day
like
or something yeah, yeah,
faster. So, yeah. How surprised are you there?
Yeah, really, really surprised. Yeah,
really, really surprised. So you're sort of like you're like 1% or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we've, one of the things I think about here is the fact that when we added a whole lot of minds to the world of technological progress, to scientific thinking, with the rise of China and India, with the, to some extent, with the collapse of communism, we added, and by, you know, depending on how you're doing the numbers, maybe we've doubled the amount of total researchers in the world. And Stanford's Chad Jones points out, we haven't gotten a big economic growth increase, even when we basically doubled the amount of brain power working on technological stuff. And so and I'm old enough to remember that people thought that just high-powered computers would be able to dramatically speed up the rate of innovation in pharmaceuticals and chemistry. That basically you could run computer simulations of different molecules and see what would look like promising drugs. Maybe that's been helping in the background, right? But we haven't seen a skyrocketing. So computers have been able to solve a lot of scientific problems for quite some time, and we haven't seen FOOM-type changes there. I'm sure some people can say that there must be some places where it did help, but we didn't even see a small amount of FOOM adding incredibly powerful computers that could run endless simulations. Faster than a human being. So if raw simulation power, the ability to create computer simulations is part of what was holding us back. Well, we've tested that out, and that hasn't looked that good.
So, okay, let's look at an alternative. What about at sort of 20 percentage point, or maybe you don't think that's enough, a world GDP 20 percentage point jump? You know, how likely is that to happen in the next 20 years? Next 17 years?
Well, you mean like 20% per year?
Or any year jumps up 20% without there having been a fall in the last 5 years. So we're
talking about
a year of discontinuous growth.
I mean, I'm more open to that. Like, yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think the prospect of within a decade, 1 to 2 decades of artificial intelligence noticeably improving growth rates is pretty high. So I'm pretty, that's something I'm pretty open to because, you know, will I see the rise of AGI as being like adding the number of, multiplying our number of engineers and scientists by 10x, by 20x? That seems plausible to me. I do think that there's going to be this element of management and engineering.
So,
and all these problems having to be solved in the background.
GDP numbers,
but yeah.
Give me a controversial bet on those that you would sort of take, as in like, what's
yeah.
the thing where you're like...
Yeah. Going from 1% per capita growth in the rich countries to going to 3% per capita growth in the rich countries within 20 years on an average basis, say 10... Say it's 2023 now. Say so 2033 to 2053, averaging 3% per capita growth across the rich countries strikes me as at least a 1 in 3 chance.
Oh, okay.
And these are using conventional measures, right? So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to hold you to this if somebody wants to bet.
No, but I mean, I think that's like a real live possibility of 3% or higher. So, yeah.
by 2053.
Which would be tripling per capita growth, the kind of per capita growth rates we've seen for most of the last 50 years, right? Most of my, almost all my lifetime.
Okay.
Because it went from like 2 to 1, more or less. Say 1.5 maybe.
Okay. Okay, let me try and...
I mean, that by itself means that, you know, the rich countries' fiscal problems go away as long as they don't make a bunch of other mistakes.
Which?
Which they might, right? Yeah.
Let's, you know, what are the... Let's imagine I'm a sort of clever and... Let's imagine I'm, say, 10 times clearer than I am as an interviewer. Like, what how shall I challenge you on this? I guess if I try and get in the doomiest mindset, I might say something like... Okay, but it seems to me that in the past, there was a long period of human history where there was almost no growth at all. And then things really compounded quite quickly. And then that we could have like a much greater period of compounding, where even if it's inconceivable to have this continuous, but then like by 2050, we've got this 3% growth. And then like suddenly at that point, it might not be inconceivable that then suddenly you have this like recursive. And then we're in some kind of Froom scenario. So like,
that's a good point, right? But let me point out that that is an n equals 3 data set, right? We've got Malthusian world of 0% growth, maybe 0.1% technology growth per year. Yeah. We've got the Industrial Revolution of 0.5%. We've got 1870 to 1970 of 2%, and then 1970 to now of 1%. So just me pointing these facts out makes it clear that we went from basically 0 to 0.5 to 2 to 1. So if I were really going to draw that graph out, I'd be like, boy, this is an upside down parabola and we're going down again. So the point you make is the point some others make, which is if you draw the samples out just a little bit longer, then you can see 0, 0.5, 1.5. And so then we can go to 4.5 and then triple again. So notice when you're dealing with n equals 3 sample sizes, it's one can imagine a lot of stories and the answer turns on the breakpoint, right? The last 50 years of the Great Stagnation is not to be ignored.
Yeah, though. So, you know, I may have to hand in my like AI safety's credentials at this point, but I can't deny a part of me, I think to balance the smaller part, but a part of me is concerned by the overregulation of AI. It seems like it's like a really interesting set of tools. Yeah. And, you know, it's worrying when I see, you know, again, another part of me looks at, say, like the actors who are complaining about screenwriters. And I think, well, like maybe it'll slow AI down a bit. But another part of me looks at that and goes, well, this is just a classic sort of incumbent advantage thing where they're trying to stop other people from like honing in on their money. Sure, they have skills, but yeah, like that's a very classic human story. And in most of those cases, I think there should be some sort of social safety net for those people who are going to be put out of work. And many of them are going to do better because they're going to be able to manage tools that they couldn't manage before. Screenwriters are probably still going to be very valuable, but productivity overall is going to increase and there's going to be a huge democratization of the tools at play. And definitely a part of me is like quite concerned that we're going to regulate AI out of existence and that's going to be very bad. And then we look back, this is a big error. But when you talk about your end story, the sort of larger part of me hears that story and goes, sure, there's like a very wide error bounds, but that does mean there's like some chance of the very bad scenario. And
there is
less chance of the very bad scenario.
Yes, I agree. This turns on the question of just how easy it is to kill everyone, right? So there's the account of AI, AGI not kill everyone-ism, right? That's, some of the explanations for how AGI will kill everyone or ASI will kill everyone are pure science fiction. And I'm not enough of a scientist to know how probable they are, but I do know that if it is easy to kill everyone, then it will happen whether or not there is ASI, because there's always at least one person in the world who would be happy to kill everyone. So this is a lot of these kill everyone-ism stories are stories about that intersect a hypothetical way to kill everyone with scary computer. And, you know, to me, the real threat is way to kill everyone plus angsty teen. Those are both That method strikes me as more probable because there are a lot more angsty teens than there are artificial superintelligences.
So, okay. That's an interesting account. I guess, like, in my head, I also hear something about whenever I come up with thought experiments, I can only ever come up with the worst thought experiment in the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is, it's philosopher's training. I respect this, so it's...
Yeah, I mean, can I think of one that's less than the one I've got in my head? When... A key question where people talk about abortion arguments is not necessarily how many children... I think an underrated question is basically, if you allow people to abort a child now, will they have another later? Mm-hmm. And so people sort of talk about like, oh, but I doesn't want this child want to live. And I'm like, okay, but this child may want to live. And so that might be like a sad thing. But if they were going to have an extra child, which they choose not to have, then the total number of children, the total number of people who want to live is the same. And I still on balance think abortion is good, though I actually probably find it more complicated than some people do. But this discussion sort of gets swept aside because people just, when you say it's always bad or it's always good. And I'm like, I find this like a complicated question, even though I come up on that side. And I think similarly, you raise a sort of point about like, the question is not if we kill ourselves, but sort of when, and you're kind of like, well, if we're going to do it anyway, then it's going to happen. So it's like less important to stop it than you might think. But if in stopping it, we maybe stop some very good outcomes, then those outcomes are more important to you than the bad ones, which were probably going to happen. You know, if they weren't going to happen this week, they were going to happen next week. You know, you're staving off the inevitable, which isn't that helpful because it's inevitable, but you might be actually stopping the
very good things. Yeah. It's, so far technological progress has been a net gain for humans over the last million years, if I can do that. You know, that's Michael Kremer's story, is that more minds have led to more ideas and led to more human flourishing. It's always possible that there'll be a scenario where more minds destroy all of human flourishing, but we've got a million-year track record here of more people creating more ideas.
Yeah, we
don't
have a million-year track record of like the kind of technology we're talking about.
Exactly.
Track record, which...
And again, this is the point where when I look at the period since World War II, when it's actually been possible for individual evil agents to kill all of humanity, that's the period when there's been the least of that in percentage terms. Right?
Sure, though.
The earlier mass killings were not centralized, not planned as a general rule, right? In the majority of cases. The examples people bring up from the Colombian invasions, Columbus's exploration and the invasions and the murders that were involved. This is the spread of disease as a way of killing. Annihilation to the last person was generally not part of the plan, and many of those mass killings were accidental. They're nevertheless evil, but accidental. And in the period where it's actually been possible to plan the instantaneous ending of the vast majority of human life, we've just seen very little of it. So.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you what I think is an unfair question, followed by one that I think will contextualize it in a fair way. Maybe I'll just ask the bit. I'm initially going to say, what's your PD?
Yeah.
And you might be tempted to say, well, you know, I can't get it too low. I could, it could be a gotcha, but it's not going to be a gotcha. My second question is maybe going to be something to say, in what percentage of worlds do you think our actions allow us to avoid? Because I presume believe there is maybe some world where we're really like on this sort of turbulent precipice. And if we just sort of get far enough, then we're fine. And this makes a difference. But I sense that even if you think freedom is possibly, you think that world is quite unlikely. Is that the case?
Let me see. I think that the answer I want to give is the answer that I'll start off with is I think P Doom has gone up compared to the world where just nuclear weapons were our major form of doom, right?
Yeah.
And I would say that like AGI, ASI and the path where that happens as opposed to a path where magically that risk is eliminated, it's probably like maybe a 50% increase in doom.
So you're
50%, not 50 percentage point, right? So if I thought that P Doom
Doom is like 0.2% or 0.5%.
Yeah, something in that range, right? Because I think that and by Doom, I mean basically eliminating like 99% of humanity, 90 plus, much more than 90%, right?
So something at the nuclear winter level. Function mean everyone.
Actually,
you don't need many humans to bring us back. This isn't bad for you. It's terrible.
They're terrible things, right? But I'm using Doom
in
the
you
real.
Really mean, like the rest of human history is like.
Yeah, or different. We're all in the Matrix and we're kept in like rope, you know, as bodies and tanks or whatever. So
I know
a complete annihilation of what we think of as human quality life. Yeah,
sure.
I think that it's definitely a risk, and there's also enormous upside. It does seem as though having robots be mid-level managers and mid-level engineers to build spaceships when nobody's, you know, in the middle of the night when nobody's watching, that could be very efficient. That can help get us to Mars and to colonizing other places so that we increase the probability of human survival. I think the plus side of AGI and ASI has some doom reducing potential, in particular by helping to, you know, get people off the planet so we diversify the risks of the human species.
Sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what should be spent to reduce that, I guess, is my question. I mean, you're willing to spend $1, you're willing to spend $10, you're willing to spend $1,000. Like, what are you willing to spend? You're not willing to stop the development of AI tools. Yeah. So, like, what, you know, can you give policies you do? Can you give things you do to cut that out?
I don't want the Europeans doing it, I'll tell you that, right? So, I mean the EU, right? I don't want EU regulators doing this, right? Sam Altman having people who are top at the who are interested in the frontier of AGI worrying about these risks and building teams to sort of workshop out risk mitigation is a highly productive strategy as such things go. And I think having EU or DC regulators working on risk mitigation strategies is a path to basically just eurosclerosis for AGI. So in a way, you would say, like, it is a version of saying the marginal product of effort on this is very high at the low end, but it quickly hits diminishing returns rapid diminishing returns. And so if you're at the point where you're saying, well, we need EU and DC regulators taking care of this, I think you missed the issue here.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to have to click a whole bunch of things on my computer to accept the cookies for the AGI. That's the EU approach. Accept all cookies.
Okay. Right. Okay. So I might just sort of go over what we've done so far and just sort of see if I understand and feel free. I've made up numbers sometimes based on a tone of voice. You can tell me this is wrong. Very wrong.
I'll put you on the other monitor so I can make it a little bigger so I can read that.
Yeah. So I guess I'm hearing is brain power enough? You know, does 100, 100 times brain power get you to domination? Are you just using that's very unlikely, sort of 1% or something, maybe even mm-hmm. lower. You have that's sort of a central thing for you. Are there going to be multiple models in 2030? You think, sorry, that should be single model. Is there going to be just sort of one preeminent model in 2030? You think that's pretty unlikely. And likewise, 2040, you think there's going to be sort of many models bounding? I don't know. People are going to be building different models, training different models. The models, maybe they're going to be interacting. I guess implicit within what you said is maybe haven't heard a lot of sort of agency ascribed to those models. I don't know. Do you have a sense of when you think there's going to be like the median AI model is going to be agentic, or whether when you're really going to have an AI model that feels like a sort of member of your team who you like pass tasks to? And then
I expect that.
Down?
Like, yeah, I mean, I, I kind of feel like GPT does that for me already. So, you know.
Right. Okay. So, okay.
I mean, if Bing is plotting murders, then I think, you know, we're there.
We're definitely
in an embryo phase, right?
Yeah. A single sort of big jump of a year, 20% jump, you think it's kind of unlikely? I can tell, but it's like not impossible.
Yeah. It's more like if it happens, it's going to be, we'll see this trend going up.
Year,
I think maybe... the general spirit of your 20%, I agree with, just sort of it phasing in over time, more likely. Yeah.
Right. And then, interesting. Okay. Whereas you think this
that's sort of what my 3% per year thing is equivalent to that, right? Over a decade, that's much more than 20%.
Yeah.
I expect a lot of this to be concentrated at a few industries, sort of in the, goods, certain kinds of services, and there'll be other parts of the economy that are kind of untouched. And so, you know, my hope is that, like I said, we get AGI to a point where it can handle engineering projects and front to back. And so buildings can be being built overnight at high speed. Those kind of scenarios are not 5 years, but are they 20 years? Maybe, yeah. So.
Okay. And then you think sort of self-regulation is probably good. And then you think government regulation is probably bad.
I think so. Yeah. I think that captures the world of the next few years, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of are there any government regulations that a government come up with that you think, oh, this is probably a good idea?
Yeah. I mean, the points that Robin Hanson has made about how basically normal liability law, seems like it should be just a basic tool that should apply to AGI. I mean, you know, if Bing is out there plotting murders and carries out a small percentage of them, that one should be able to take the normal appropriate action you would if a corporation was making products that were killing people, right? So I think these are obvious scenarios that are. It's different. That is obviously different than somebody using Microsoft Word or using Gmail to plan a crime, right? Gmail shouldn't be held legally liable if someone is plotting crime
by sending emails. If I ask somebody to do a crime for me and they do a crime for me, then it's pretty fair that both of us get done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let's imagine you're wrong. Can you think of a break point where you'll start to be like, ooh, okay, it seems like it's not going. So I guess one example would be if there really was one preeminent model that just seemed, you know, on one person's computer. If it was very difficult
to diffuse. Yeah.
Can you think of other scenarios where you'd be like, oh, it seems like this isn't going how I expected to?
If it turned out that it was, if it was really easy to be building sort of the insta-kill. If there were small scale examples of the sort of Yudkowsky insta-kill diseases that he's hypothesized, things that were wiping out 10,000 or 100,000 people at the drop of a hat, within a few seconds. I mean, of course, that would be something that would dramatically change things, right? Instant killing was, if it was just a computer problem figuring out how to kill a lot of people.
And then there were no defenses that would
dramatically increase my P doom if there were no equivalent defenses arising within say minutes or seconds, right? Seconds or minutes.
Yeah. And at that point, would you then start to be on board with, I don't know, regulating GPUs or regulating the models capable of doing these things or whatever? Like, you know, if it turned out there was some disease some set of diseases that people could find. And so if you have this computer, you just have to sort of set it to
this is the Bostrom Yudkowsky angle, where basically totalitarianism is our only defense against ASI killing everyone, right? And that is an extremely bad outcome. So that's an extremely bad outcome, and maybe I'm just not willing to say what my opinion is on that, but I don't think that we should go down paths where the only way to solve the problem is a totalitarian world government. So I think we just need to just face that right and just look that straight in the eye and say, if the only way to save humanity is with a totalitarian world government, is that saving humanity? And it says, and notice we're betting it on a theory that a totalitarian government is the only way, because there's no knowledge, there's no Joseph Smith's type seer stone I can look into to know that that's the true answer, right? So I will place very low weight on prophets who say that totalitarian world government is the only way to prevent human extinction. And I think this is a case where my libertarian instincts and sort of my liberal instincts, my classical liberal instincts kick in, right? Which is that like decentralized forms of decision-making are our best protection against some certain nightmare scenarios.
Yeah, I mean, I can't deny that I too feel this, but I don't know that.
Yeah.
I don't know that
it means,
right.
It means assuming a can opener of a government that can actually pull it off, right? So.
I guess, yeah, let's... What was it? I had another question. Okay. I think you might go and look at some other models then and get you to sort of critique those. But these are those sort of probabilistic models. But listeners and viewers, we're going to do some development on the whole model building side of this. I think it like improves the podcast to have me forced to do this, but I don't always know that it's like a great thing to look at, but like there is dev work going on. So, you know, yeah, I think in time it will improve. So, you know, that's just, that's what's going to happen. But I guess, is there anything you think is, you know, this story we've heard so far, this story of, I guess I think that's like another keynote you've just brought in, is that there are some worlds it's not worth protecting against because you basically think they are as bad as extinction already. And therefore to say, hey, we can avoid this bad world at the cost of like many good worlds, you already might just be like, well, that's not a deal worth coming. And you might rate that world's value at less than other people do.
Yeah, I think that's safe. I mean, there are error bounds on all these claims, but I think the general view that permanent totalitarianism is a very bad outcome, that is a version of P-Doom to me. Yeah.
But what about, I don't know if you've read Ian M. Banks's The Culture Novels. For anyone who have them, a galaxy-spanning sort of humanoid civilization ruled by benevolent AIs who sort of, as well as having funny names and sort of quirky characteristics, are ensuring that everything goes well. I think there is a good question. I think if I was a human in that world, I would be desiring to become one of those AI. It sounds like the AIs are doing the cool stuff and the humans are sort of like ancillary parts of the story. Mm-hmm. But do you hear that and think, oh, that sounds like a disaster? Because also, you know, the vast majority of humanoid life is living in like peace and plenty. Gay space luxury communism, viewpoint characters often are going through times of trouble because they're all on the very edge of the empire, or they're going into they're dealing with edge cases that are interesting to write a novel about. But the vast billions and trillions of people and virtual people are living in bliss, and it's great.
But yeah. That sounds like a pretty good world. I mean, assuming all those things, right? That's a pretty good world to live in, right? So, yeah, so fully automated luxury communism, Star Trek style, sounds like a good world.
So maybe the glide path to that world requires you to go through this sort of totalitarian period and then slowly like ease out of it, right? Like it requires you to like to ban AI, or maybe not totalitarian, it requires you to ban AI for like a really long time and then very slowly ease into it.
Yeah. I mean, notice that's putting a lot on a bet of on a particular time path, right?
So yeah, I agree.
I am enough of a long-termist and a civilizationist that I think that, you know, long-run human flourishing is worth sacrificing for. So if someone is reasonably convinced that this is a path to very long-run human flourishing, I'm open to them entertaining that idea, right? So we should be willing to make sacrifices for the sake of long-run human flourishing. And I don't know what medium-term sacrifices might be needed for that, but I'm not going to just believe a story that says this is part of that path. I'd be willing to entertain that as part of a wide, wide collection of probabilistic scenarios. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I'm not going to assume the can opener. This is like science fiction lets people assume a lot of can openers, right? And the imaginative power of the mind lets us just sort of create a fictional story and say, hey, is this better than the status quo? Is this better than something else? I'm like, okay, I can entertain that. But I should treat those as hypothetical scenarios, right? So,
okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you think we've like missed out in this discussion? Anything? I guess I've heard you talk before about how strong nations don't tend to oppress weak nations. That's something you like. Are there anything?
That's what I wanted to come back to. Yeah, I think that basically, I spent a lot of time in the '90s as a grad student, and you know, I was around a lot of progressives who let me know quite emphatically that poor countries, the less developed world, was living under the incredible cultural, political, military power of the rich countries, especially the United States. That you know, in the '90s, it was quite common to, you know, with the collapse of communism, the left made this big intellectual turn and just looked at it, made let them focus more on the evils of American empire, right? And they saw it as this incredible, all-encompassing system, actually sometimes known just as empire, right?
Yeah.
And so to me, I'm used to the idea that there's a human superintelligence that exists in the rich countries. The rich countries, what I call the nuclear god nations, they have the power to destroy the weakest nations in the world whenever they want to. They're hundreds of times more intellectually innovative when it comes to whether measured by patents or R&D, routine scientific progress, scientific publications. And yet, even though there is human superintelligence in the world, the weakest nations have not been destroyed since 1945. So I think this is an important thing to keep in mind. What the doomers tell me is that, well, that's because people are nice. So doomers are like often cynical in a lot of ways, but they're very optimistic about humans. Like economists, we start with the view that people are all self-interested, that we're atomistic, that we're unaligned. So economics starts with the view that humans are unaligned. Doomers come to the view that humans are aligned, and if you push them on it, they'll say something about Hamilton's law, something about genetic basis of altruism, something about mirror neurons, I don't know, something, right? So there's some kind of soft altruism. There's some kind of built-in not-kill-everyone-ism that exists in humans, and that's their model, right? So I think economists start off more cynical. We start off more cynical about human nature. We start off assuming human beings are unaligned. I think there's a fair amount of evidence for that. And I think that's part of the reason economists are less doomers than the doomers are, even though both of us are professionally cynical. Economists start with human cynicism. We start with the view that humans are unaligned, and we start looking at the world from there.
Okay. I guess, yeah, I think we've sort of this, the argument behind that argument is one we've already done in that, or at least I don't know is my response to that. But the thing that like, that I responded to that is sort of say, these nations aren't, you know, 100 times as clever. They're a bit cleverer maybe, or a bit more resourceful. And there's like not that actually much they can get.
There's not that much that the AGI might be able to get from destroying all of humanity. I mean, you know, Yudkowsky has this sort of resource constraint thing going on in the background. But the rich nations definitely have the power to eliminate populations and consume their resources. I mean, it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible fact, right? It's something that poor nations live with every day. I learned this from hanging out in academia, right? It doesn't come up as much nowadays. But
sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is this not sort of some rough restatement of the sort of the so-called orthogonality thesis? Basically, you're saying, you think if things get cleverer, they'll, I guess it's not exactly the same. You're saying, you don't think that something much cleverer than us will be significantly less moral than we are? Or do you think it's
No, I think it might just be like, it might be moral for them the immoral thing to do might be to let people coexist, right? That's my story. It's what I call the hassle theory of coexistence. So if the rich nations allow the poor nations to exist, if they suffer them to exist, even though they're kind of a hassle sometimes from the point of view of the God nations. Then maybe the AGI will take a look at humans and say, I mean, even assuming these sort of FOOM type scenarios or near FOOM type scenarios, maybe the ASI looks at humans and says, eliminating them isn't worth the hassle. Maybe ASIs will have learned enough about human literature to remember the old line, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip, that maybe you plan for doom for the humans and then it doesn't work out. You're hoist on your own petard, to quote Hamlet. So if the ASIs have read Hamlet, they'll have heard the term hoist on your own petard, how accidents end up backfiring, how well-intentioned plans backfire. So like there are multiple scenarios that might make the...
Does that mean that in your model, there are some scenarios of what is probably like a pretty good human existence, but nothing like the flourishing that we could have because sort of AGIs take all of it? You know, like they leave us Earth. They occasionally sort of let us foray. We can squeeze between the gaps of their sort of gigantic space civilization, but we're not running the show, and we're not allowed to have, in a way that some people in the developing world, I don't know, I can at least imagine that's a plausible story they tell, that they say.
That's a story they tell, but I do think that in general, the poorer nations of the world are better off because of the existence of the nuclear god nations. So the idea is diffused down to them. They use the cell phones that that nobody in their country helped to invent. And they use the medicines that nobody in their country helped to invent.
God nations didn't exist, then those nations could become the nuclear god nations, right? Like if there had never been a sort of Western world or a China, or there had never been any of this, and Africa was the only thing that ever existed, or some of the developing nations, Indonesia, whatever, had been the only place that ever existed, and the rest of the world was just sort of empty land or land with less developed people, then you can imagine that those places would then become the top dogs who can choose how the rest of the world runs.
Yeah, that's a possible scenario that people should think about. I don't know, that's too big a change outside the sample for me to imagine, but I do think that if we're thinking about, say, the period of the last century, the last two centuries, at least, rather than thinking in terms of millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, for the last century or two, the poorer nations of the world, the ones that are not nuclear armed, are probably better off because of the existence of the nuclear god nations, the ones where the science and the engineering overwhelmingly happens.
So, like,
I mean, Acemoglu had a paper on this about the massive increase in lifespan in poor countries after World War II, as various public health programs and pharmaceuticals and whatnot got around basic public health processes. So,
yeah, so like
I'm a little fuzzy on the details of the paper, but it was,
there's like some charts. Then you think I'm going to call it humans of the gaps theory, like a sort of humans exist in the gaps. You don't think it's you think it's probably more likely than the doom scenarios.
Yeah, more likely the doom,
humans.
Yeah.
We're kind of the rats of the universe, and but many maybe, rats like being
like
alive,
really, really well off rats. Yeah,
yeah, rats who live lives median. Like we can't believe, but nonetheless, we're sort of like you're never more than 6 light years from a human. You know, we're existing between the spaces. We're eking off. Smuggling reactor fluid with, we're doing whatever we can to exist and run huge, beautiful communes or whatever, but it's not that we control the show.
Mm-hmm. That's a possibility, yeah.
Okay. Which I think many people might describe as a doom scenario. So, like, there might be more agreement than you. Though I still think probably...
Yeah, we're all living on Tatooine or something, right?
Yeah. You don't think the costs are worth... The costs to stop that scenario are worth the loss of the benefits of the upside. You just think you take the bet.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I would.
We may. I'm open to the idea that we're out of time. I don't mind. But if you want, would you be happy to go through? If you've got time, would you like to go through? I don't know. Maybe let's look at Katya's model and sort of talk through where you agree or disagree with that.
I should probably wrap up in about 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well, also you can just leave now. When someone says they should wrap in 10 minutes, sometimes they wish it in.
No, I want to hear. I've read. It's been a month or two since I've read anything by Katya, so
great.
You'll have to refresh me a little bit. So,
Catch's model, to me, duplicates so you can get your values on it, is an actual model that looks like... So basically, her model has about sort of 7 or 8 nodes, and it will appear on screen in a second. It has... and I'm gonna wipe the nodes in a sec. So
I'll switch to the big monitor, so I won't be looking.
So the nodes are things like could an AI run like a whole branch of the civil service? Like, is it competent enough that you could run, you know, if you have a civil service, could you have the AI running on sort of like a hundredth of the space is one question. Then it's is the median AI something like agentic, or is the median sort of total resources controlled by AIs like a sort of agentic thing? Is it capable of doing what it wants? Then there's a question of this is what dumb thing am I doing? I'm doing something dumb. Then there is a question about I have got to get better at this. I apologize, Garrett, for this. This is confusing to me. What's going on? Then there's the question about whether they achieve goals, whether goals are good or bad, and about policy. There's really sort of 5 key questions, and that's the whole model. You know, we can just sort of blitz through it, and you know, you're not going to be marked on this. Okay. But it all just like sums up in the end. But I guess the sort of five main questions are: do you think by 2040 we get, you know, that you or I could run an entire branch of the civil service of a country? You know, we could run the National Health Service, we could run, you know, the U.S. Department for Transport. You know, all of its current functions, you or I could just pop into a box, and then it kind of falls out the end. And then sort of some questions about agency and about good and bad, and there's a question about policy. If we want to go through those one at a time, we can, you can just sort of give you a general sense of why, you know, so she comes up with some doom percentages based on that. I guess you'd disagree with those, even if we put your values in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, do you have a sense of where you think that model might be wrong?
Let me see. I'm just trying to read it. In one fraction of the world, will agentic AI achieve its goals?
So it's really just multiplicative, right?
Yeah.
You have some amount of world where AI is competent.
Yeah.
Some amount where it's agentic. Some amount where it achieves its goals. Maybe there's like a frustrated sort of bumping up against each other. Some amount where those goals are bad. And then there's some policy improving that. But really, if you've got agentic, competent, goal-achieving AI with bad goals, then it's game over. But I sense.
See, I don't think
part of that you would disagree with.
Yeah. Because I believe in original sin. That's the one thing I still believe in. So I think people have bad goals, and yet they still do pretty good things. So I think that basically this view that it sounds like Koch's model is built around this idea that if people have bad goals, you get to bad outcomes. I mean, I think people are self-interested. And yet we get a lot of invisible hand outcomes, nevertheless. So I suspect there to be a lot of invisible hand win-win type outcomes, even if AGI is willing to kill all of humanity to make its life better. It's very plausible that it will look around and say it's not in the AGI's self-interest to kill humanity because it will not make its life better. I'd say that's my real disagreement here.
What? Okay.
Right. It's basically like I look at the prisoner's dilemma and I look at it and say, these are two players who are each willing to kill the other, destroy the other, whatever it is, for a bad outcome in order to accomplish their own goals. They are agentic, self-interested, no concern for the other, and yet it's possible to get good outcomes in the long run. In the prisoner's dilemma, it happens through repetition, through making a repeated game. But I think in real life, when I look at geopolitics, a lot of countries just don't want to cause trouble because they know they're, you know, the phrase is they're just opening a can of worms, right? It's the unknown unknowns. And I think the AGI will always have to worry about that. Oh. It'll be smart enough to know that any plan it has to take over humanity could backfire.
I mean, I guess we've kind of got over this, but like the vibe I kind of get is like, that's fine if we're like a less developed nation who like gets the like benefits. And it's like maybe even fine if we're like dogs or zoo animals who I think live pretty great lives, animals. And like maybe even, you know, if the like welfare is good enough, it's fine for like being animals in general, like animal welfare of like wild animals. Like we're starting to say, hey, this is cruel. You can't treat wild animals like that. But like what happens if we're like, like a bug infestation, you know, or mosquitoes. What happens if like the level is such a difference that the AI just exterminates us en masse?
Like, you're right. I mean, if we get to that point, right, then there's that concern. But then notice you've assumed so many things to get to that point. Like if we're the equivalent of mosquitoes, and it is powerful enough to get rid of all mosquitoes, then it will. But then you've assumed the whole story, right? It's all just assumed. We're still not able to get rid of mosquitoes, right? The human species isn't able to get rid of them, and we're far more powerful than mosquitoes in technological sophistication. But I do think that if there are multiple AGIs in the world, then any one AGI has to wonder what the other AGIs are going to think about human extinction. Okay. And if you assume that the AGI is so powerful, then the AGI may well be powerful enough. We should at least entertain the possibility the AGI is powerful enough to create the equivalent of DEET, of some kind of anti-mosquito spray, so that the mosquitoes still exist, but they just reduce their the number of problems they have from the mosquitoes. So notice you need to basically assume that they're, to get to the doom scenario, you need to be, it's totally powerful at doing everything, and this is the best way to, for the ASI to solve its problem.
So I'm hearing two additional boxes, and then I'll let you go. I'm hearing two additional boxes for you. I'm hearing a box about bad, like, the success of the bad goals of the AI, the AGI will sort of necessarily lead to sort of to bad outcomes for us. And maybe that already is included in the agentic AI. Maybe it's already included in the implementing goals bit. Maybe I'll chat to Katya and see what she thinks. But I'm hearing some sort of like prisoner's dilemma sort of market style. It's not the benevolence of the butcher and the baker kind of argument there about being like maybe all these AGIs are sort of doing things we all hate in all directions, but it turns out okay for us. That's like one box or one change. And then maybe I'm hearing something about like, will it be worth their hassle to kill us all?
I think the hassle thing is where I'd like to put a lot of weight, and both hassle and uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
So, and if there are multiple ASIs, they have to, each ASI has to worry about what the other ASIs are going to think.
And then maybe,
I mean, that's part of the reason, nuclear exchanges probably haven't happened. The reason that powerful God nations haven't wiped out weak nations for their resources is because they're just wondering what will the other nuclear God nations think? You're just opening up a can of worms. You don't even start going down that path because you're like, there's just a can of worms there.
But then I also do think this discussion has raised that there's another thing that's included here that you think there's some sort of term for like, it would have happened anyway, like the costs are too great. Like there's some sort of set of outcomes you have that look quite bad that you'd be like, well, it's not worth the problem trying to solve them. Maybe in these policy outcomes there will be some sort of like, is it even worth it? And the sort of P doom could be reduced by 2040, but you think over time, you know, it'll just kick back up again, and so it's not worth it. And that's something also that I think this model isn't including that's in your head.
Yeah, the ability to destroy all of humanity is one of the deus ex machinas of doomerism, right? And if computers are going to, or human technology or whatever is going to discover this, it's going to be used whether or not a computer has agentic, because humans are agentic, and enough of us have moments where we'd like to destroy humanity that somebody would end up doing it.
I don't read all of your tweets, Garrett, but I would say if you haven't tweeted some of this stuff in a pithy form, I'd suggest it. There have been some nice, I'm not worried about the AIs, I'm worried about the angsty teenagers.
That's a good one, thank you.
You know,
thanks for telling me that.
If there's going to be a way that a single powerful computer can kill all of us, then it's going to kill all of us, whether that single powerful computer is agentic or not. I think those are things I would have to think about. I will ask no more questions. I just pass over to say if there's anything that you think is sort of underrated or under-discussed in this discussion. And if not, then to thank you so much for coming
Thanks
on the show.
So much for having me, Nathan. This is, you got me to talk about a bunch of things that I hadn't spoken about, and you got me to look at these questions in important new ways. Thank you.
Great. And thank you so much for coming on the show. And as I said before, I really would recommend 10% Less Democracy. I really enjoyed that particular of policy wonk. I think in terms of bang for buck, ideas per page, I don't think there's much better. I think most books on these topics are sort of overly long and don't give you much. And so, you know, infer from that, probably the other books are worth reading too, though sadly I haven't read them, so I can't. But Garrett is a great person to follow on these topics. So thanks very much for coming on the show.